This episode is sponsored by Sanebox, a great way to focus on the important emails and boost your productivity.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company. From seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
From exuberance to panic in just about 48 hours. Speculation is high, but the underbelly is soft. Bringing you episode number 666. Hoping that's not a prophecy, and a follow-up to the key reversal indicator. All this and much more on episode number 666 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And a great big hello to you. I'm Andrew Horowitz, and I am the host of the Disciplined Investor Podcast, as well as the president of Horowitz & Company. Yeah, we're an investment advisory firm, so what we're talking about here is not just theory. It's what we actually implement each and every day with our clients and our investments. So it's not one of these podcasts that are just kind of trying to ramble around, find their way, have a podcast, because they have a podcast, and they need to have a podcast because everybody has to have a podcast. No, we're one of the OGs in this whole game. Started back in 2007 or so, and we wrote the first of the books that I wrote, The Disciplined Investor, Essential Strategies for Success. We'll talk about that a little bit today because, yes, we're giving that away. So stay tuned for how you can get your copy of that. But we had a pretty wild week, and it was pretty, well, it was frightening at a point there, wasn't it? It was kind of weird. It was this massive sell-off that happened, and it was just as the major indices seemed as though there was just no stopping it. And the upward trajectory was continuing on. There was all this excitement that was going on, and we saw speculation running high in stocks like Hertz and the bankrupt companies that are out there, like Whiting Petroleum and Chesapeake and JCPenney, and it was all over the news and all over the headlines about how people are just making all this money. I saw stocks up 3, 4, 5, 600%, 1,200% in a day, only to fall back right afterwards. But when you look at when that kind of thing happens, when you start seeing that this excessive amount of speculation, well, you know that it's not sustainable. In fact, when we look at the S&P 500, you look back to June 5th, and there was this exhaustion gap, I'll call it, and that came out right on the heels of the payrolls report. We saw a bit of a follow-through on Monday. This is after a month-and-a-half-long major rally that took levels of the S&P back up to the unchanged position for the year. Dow Jones Industrial Average still was negative. NASDAQ 100, the key tech-heavy index, was up for the year about 6% or so. That was at that point of, what are we going to call it? We'll call it peak exuberance or peak speculation. But that's where it was on that Friday. We saw on Monday things coming up the following Monday. That was last Monday. And it was kind of a little bit weird because after this major run and after the realization that, you know, millions of people unemployed and the economy is bad. You know, all the things we've talked about, right? All these kinds of situations with earnings coming in for the first quarter, okay, but yet pulling guidance for the rest of the year and uncertainty about that. And who knows what's going to happen with more stimulus or not? What's going to happen with this virus? We didn't know. But yet they're bidding up stocks. We talked about this a lot. And if you recall, in fact, we had been discussing the KRI or the key reversal indicator for a bit. As a matter of fact, I highlighted something very extraordinary, something that's never happened before historically from my perspective, going back as far as, I think it was 2010. And that I talked about on Monday during our pop-up after-hours webinar that everybody's invited to. It's a Q&A discussion starts at 4:30 in the afternoon on Mondays. You can register over on the Discipline Investor. We talked about this. I've told you about this. And on Monday, I was like, wait a second. I mean, whoa, let's stop. Let's talk about where we are. Because on Friday, I saw a level for this key reversal indicator. We'll call it the KRI. Okay, just call the KRI from here. I saw a level that I never saw before, and it was a plus 7. I've seen plenty of 5s and 6s. 7 is the max. The scale goes from a negative 7 to a 7, plus 7. Negative 7 means severely oversold. 0 means market in equilibrium. Plus 7 means market is overheated, extreme levels, and everything in between from there. So I've seen these, you know, these plus 6s. I've seen these plus 5s. I've seen negative 7s once. Negative 6 is a lot, but never going back to 2010, which is the longest we can look back for this indicator with the information that's available for the underside of how it is constructed. And here we go. We get a plus 7. Closed at a plus 6 on Friday. Monday, we get another plus 7. So now we're starting to get a cluster of this. You may say, well, what the heck are you talking about with this plus 7? Was KRI? Yeah, this is important to understand. But we saw not only the plus 7, but we saw close. We saw the market close, and the close of that day, the indicator stopped at a pinned out position. The max it can go at a plus 7. And I said, this is extreme. I've never seen this before. Now, we do know that markets can go a lot further than anticipated, and it could be a lot farther than anyone has the belief that it can go for a lot of different reasons, both on the downside and the upside. We know that, okay. But this was worrisome. And that's why I talked about it. That's why I put it up on Twitter several times. I said, we got to watch out for this. This is not right. So let me take you through why and what this indicator is all about. So I developed this indicator because I wanted to get a feel for the, we'll call it the fear or greed that's embedded inside of a market, understanding what exactly is happening with the market in terms of levels of overbought, oversold. And I wanted to bring together these technical and psychological components that can provide me with both a historical reference and going back and seeing in time, and then charting that against the markets, and then looking at current conditions. Because if we can correlate that there was an extreme level of, let's say, oversold or overbought levels, overheated, or what happens during markets in equilibrium, what happens when markets get too extreme on either side, and then be able to make some decisions from that, that would be very helpful, right? That was the thought. So we set out to create this utilizing a variety of technical and psychological indicators. And historically, I've seen, like I said, a lot of levels near the negative 5, negative 6, clusters of those readings over time where they happen for several days at a time. And when it gets to those levels where you get a severe oversold, what do we do for our trading portfolios? Maybe we'll take off some of our short positions, possibly enter into some longer hedging so we can hedge both long and short. So we may want to do that. And it was helpful for our trading strategy, particularly for our trading portfolios for our clients. Now, what I found historically is something very interesting. And that is that usually the oversold indicators are a much better reading to look at, and they're more accurate and usable. Because a lot of people, you know, think about what people do, the average investor. The average investor goes about their day putting money into the market on a regular basis, either through pensions or profit sharings or buying stocks that are low when it comes down. Oftentimes they hold those. And when things go up, they don't really sell. When things come down, they don't really sell. They buy back in. That's the average mentality that, you know, I'm going to put money away for the long haul, whether I'm buying stocks or ETFs or mutual funds. Point is that when we find that there's a lot of fear out there and there's a lot of indication that this indicator has gone to levels to the extreme on the downside or the oversold levels, then that is often a much better clue to what's going to happen. And usually happens pretty quickly, that resolution, because that resolution has to get to the market back in equilibrium. And when you do see those downstrokes, it's often a very fast move through time. The vertical move through time is a lot faster than a horizontal consolidation over time with markets. So what you have here is a setup that you can look at. And when you look at it, you could say, well, okay, what do I want to do at this point? That's all this does. It kind of gives a very big picture, a 10,000-foot view of where the markets are from an oversold or an overbought indication. All right, fine. So like I said, I've seen these negative fives, negative six. I've seen negative sixes a couple of times where kind of you get these cluster of them and you say, you know what? It's time to back up the truck and get into some positioning that makes sense. As a matter of fact, I'll give you an example of that. So we saw the swing from a plus seven to a plus one. That's a 6-point swing on Thursday as that market was coming down. And that swing, that momentum of the move and the velocity of the move, it, what did it tell us to do? We put on a long position of small caps on a leveraged ETF towards the end of the day on Thursday as the markets were coming down, closed that position early morning near the peak on Monday because it seemed that things were so incredibly overdone on that move. That velocity move on the key reversal indicator on the sell-off on Thursday, that there would be a bit of a bounce back. Now, however long that lasts is a different discussion. Still, we're seeing that the markets are overdone to the plus side, but not as bad as they were. So the resolution that has to happen happened, in this case, quickly, 24 hours. And we can see that when we get these high levels, it's an important thing to watch. And like I said, oftentimes when you see a plus two, plus three, maybe plus four, those are continuation numbers on the upside. The resolution doesn't necessarily have to happen because people get more and more excited about where we are. So what's really interesting is it took only 2 days to get this resolution back to the markets in equilibrium. A 7% drop on the Dow Jones Industrial Average, 6% on the major indices like the NASDAQ and the S&P 500. And yeah, there was some news that need to be reviewed on why this happened and what it meant for the uptrend. But let's just say that with a VIX that is elevated in the level above 20, I mean, it's not totally unexpected, especially when we saw such a high level of froth. That was the title of last week's podcast, right? Froth much? We talked about how frothy these markets were. There was no question about this. I mean, now you may think, well, at the time, I wasn't sure. But if now you look back on it, you go, well, that made sense. So you have to have some way to allow yourself to understand objectively where markets are, especially if you're more of a trader than an investor. An investor, we could use this in a different manner. As an investor, we could look at this as buying some dips when those dips are evident and not necessarily chasing when things get too hot. There's a difference. From a trading standpoint, we look at this as, you know what? Hey, things are oversold. Let's get a quick trade in. Let's see if it can last for a couple of days till it resolves out. Or if things are overbought, we can look to take some money off the table temporarily and push back in. From an investment standpoint, that has nothing to do with anything. From an investment standpoint, especially if you're a long-term investor, what it does for us is gives us opportunities potentially to say, you know what, if markets are this overdone for this period of time, I don't know if I want to commit new capital to that right now until I can get back to a level of equilibrium where things are a little bit more reasonably valued, leveled in a technical and a psychological manner. Yes, we did see this blow off. We did see this big number on the KRI. We did see a resolution down for a day and then a pop back up on Friday. However, that has not done much for valuations. Valuations are still sky high and ridiculous for the most part. And this is what I've been talking about. I have been pounding the desk. Here we go. Pounding. I'm pounding. You may not hear it. I have been pounding the desk about making sure that you are situated right. I've been talking about this whole 1 foot out and 1 foot in process when getting involved in the markets right now because there are so many unknowns. Right now, there are so many things and these cross currents that are going on that, while I'm not suggesting you sit on the sidelines, it does mean that you need to be smart and tactical. That's important. The whole idea of being tactical in this market, I think, is the best way of doing things right now. Because just throwing your money, and especially if you've been out of the markets for a while and just having that FOMO overwhelm you to a point you're like, I can't take it. I can't take it anymore. Get me in. Everybody else is happy and smiling. I'm miserable about the markets. I can't take it anymore. And then you get a day like Thursday, which whacks 1,800 points. 5%, the entire monthly gain that we've had so far, pushes us back to a level of concern again. The VIX pops up dramatically, and it's like, wait a second. Maybe what's going on is all about the liquidity. I want to talk about that. I want to talk about some of the reasons that the market reacted so violently on Thursday and Friday with that move up 800 points, down a couple hundred points. I'm just talking about the Dow here. And then back up about 450 points by the end of the day. But first, before we do that, let's take a second and hear about something important. So let me take a second and discuss something with you. I don't know about you, but what's going on with emails these days? I mean, it's out of control. You get spam, junk, unwanted advertisements. You know what I mean? It is so distracting. And I got to tell you something. It's a huge time waster trying to sift through your emails all day, every day. But I found a great solution for you. It's called SaneBox, and it uses an artificial intelligence monitoring system for your inbox. What happens is that it basically scans all of your inboxes, and every email service works with this, and it separates the most important emails that you want to see from the ones that are just, I mean, simply time wasters. The emails that you need are in your inbox, and those that you don't are, well, scooted over to the Sane Later inbox. And working with it is really easy. If you know how email folders work, well, you got it. You know how SaneBox works. Find an email in the wrong folder, well, just move it. Nothing to learn, nothing to install. SaneBox works directly with every single email server or service that has ever been created. So you can get it for free and a $25 credit by visiting sanebox.com/TDI. That's sanebox.com/TDI. So now let's get into some color about what was going on and why were the markets so freaked out on Thursday. Let's dig into this because I think there are some lessons and some things to understand about exactly the clues that we could be watching for this. And again, this is all about right now two major issues. There's probably a few more, but there's two major issues I think that really caused this unrest in the markets on Thursday. And that was number one, that there had been a good amount of states that are seeing an increase in coronavirus cases and also reports that hospitalizations are increasing. That is not what we wanted to hear. Now, of course, we do know that there was going to be just, it's inevitable that we start opening up to more business and people go to restaurants, getting haircuts, going to the tattoo parlors, I mean, getting their mani-pedis, all the stuff that's going on. We know there was going to be some level of increase. Okay, that's a no-brainer. Everybody thought we would go through the guidelines where we're going to have 14 days at phase one and 14 days at phase two. And if we don't have any further increases, we're not going to go to phase three, or phase two is going to back up to phase one. That was the theoretical plan that was put out by the White House and the health department. Everybody bought into it. But we have now states like Florida, Texas, Arizona, South Carolina, North Carolina, that are seeing a significant increase. Other states are not only seeing case increases, but hospitalizations as well. And that is causing the governors and the state's health departments to now think about pausing any further extension of openings and even possibly going backwards from, let's say, a phase two to a phase one, where you have, instead of, let's say, 50%, of restaurants that are available to be open, 25%, and certain essential workers only on this job and that job, and maybe this is not open, but that is open. This is a problem, especially when we see hospitalizations increasing. And all the people that don't want to wear masks, they're all mad at the world about, I'm not going to wear a goddamn mask. Have at it, man. When I go out, I wear a mask. Listen, if I'm in an area that I don't have a problem, I don't care. I'm not going to make this a whole mask argument. And do me a favor. Do not email me. Please do me a favor. Before you were probably ready to do so, don't email me about the benefits or not the benefits of the mask, whatever. Listen, by putting something over my face, it's just freaking common sense that it's going to prevent something, a little bit, maybe even a 5% benefit. I don't care. And maybe it's going to actually not only help me, but it's going to help the other people from me breathing out the particles. And you may say, well, maybe it's 20% that side. I don't know. Whatever it is, it helps. And the fact that there's people that are unwilling and almost radical about it, radical, I have no time for this. It's selfish. That's what it is. I'm not going to go into a whole soapbox discussion about this, but come on, man. Seriously. Do we need to have this ridiculous, oh, you're not going to tell me what to do because I'm embarrassed. That's what it is. People are embarrassed about putting the mask on because they think they're going to look stupid. These are probably the people that grew up in the world, the people, you know, maybe yabbing about them, about the clothes they were wearing when they were in elementary school, and they didn't want to have a repercussion or a redo of that now. And they're thinking, oh, man, people are going to think I'm stupid. Look at the mask. They're not going to like the color, the look. I remembered, if you remember, back in January 24th is when I got my mask. I wasn't planning on going down this road, by the way, but what the heck? I got my mask on January 24th. I remember because I had a business meeting out of town. It was in Washington, D.C., in that area and south in Virginia, and that, well, the general vicinity. And I knew I was going to be there for a few days. And I said, you know what? I'm going to be flying. There's all this stuff going on in China and around the world. And, you know what? It's D.C. There's a lot of people that come into that hub. Planes are crowded. I'm putting on a mask. And yes, I thought, what if people look at me and think I'm stupid? Now, these are people I didn't know, so it didn't really matter. But I'm thinking, oh, I don't want to be, like, ridiculed. I put the mask on as soon as I got to the airport. Didn't take it off till I left the airport. Because there was a lot of people that I was sitting very close to. I'm happy about that because, you know what? Who knows if I didn't, what would have happened? Same thing on the way back. As a matter of fact, just to help you on this, I had two people, one on either other side of the flights, say, hey, excuse me, where'd you get the mask? I'm thinking, oh, man, here it goes. I'm in trouble. They said, I really like your mask. Where'd you get it? I'm like, oh, I got it on Amazon. I don't know what they liked about it. It was a blue color, I guess, so it was kind of cool looking. But, okay, that's when I can get. Masks were not a problem to get at that point. So all I'm saying is that we just need to, I guess the point here is we need to work together with all of this, and it's not about this side or that side or on this. I'm a Republican, I'm a Democrat, I'm an independent. I am from the South, I'm from the North, I'm from the East, I'm from the West. I'm not susceptible because I'm young, because I'm old. Hey, it's all of us. And the last thing we want to do from an economic standpoint is have further spikes and flare-ups. So maybe if there is a little bit, just a small amount, the tiniest of chances that there is a benefit from the mask, why not participate? Let's all play the game. It's mask time. You want to hear that? Let's play the mask game. You'll look fine, I promise. So, with this, we're seeing some increases in concern about the continuation of the potential rollbacks. And on top of all this, fast forward to this weekend, where we know now that there has been a further spike, or they're calling it a hotspot, actually, in a market area that is now closing the entire area down and parts of Beijing. They announced this over the weekend. It's not good. This is not good because China, and if you say to me, well, Andrew, you just had this whole discussion about masks and they all wear masks there. All right, yeah, I get it. I'm just saying, maybe it stops some of it or whatever. I'm not going to go into this. But China now has a flare-up to closing markets. They're stopping and canceling sporting activities in the Beijing area and schools that were planning on reopening or that have been open. That's a concern when they've done such a great job at mitigation and still seeing problems. And now some states, again, are thinking about rolling back some of that and even maybe even going to a higher level of this mitigation. The CDC says that hospitalizations in Montana, Arkansas, Utah, Arizona, and Texas are increasing, and that they may need to have further mitigation as well, and they may need to re-implement some of these. And it's a concern here because if you mix that with the comments from the White House talking heads recently, They say they're not closing down the economy again. Nothing is going to stop us from keeping this economy up open. There is no chance that we're going to do that, and that's a problem. First of all, not that they have the power to do so, because we know it resides in the states and the governors and the localities. But think about this for a second. If there's no chance for another stay-at-home order, people are going to take it upon themselves to make the decision of whether or not they're going to go out, whether they're going to go to that restaurant, spend money. There's a higher degree of uncertainty, because if you think about it just for a moment, we all knew what the lockdown and stay-at-home orders meant for everyone. We were all in the same situation. We knew we couldn't go out. We couldn't do this. We would try to get the takeout. Now, all of a sudden, if in fact we are not going to go back to that, the onus falls on the individual to provide their own level of security, safety, and know what to do. And that's a problem. If we leave people to decide for themselves, I mean, think about it. There's a great deal of uncertainty with that. And we know what that means for the economy. Now, with that, the second part of this is we need to add the FOMC, the Federal Open Market Committee's announcement, the conversation that Jay Powell had on Wednesday to the mix. Because it was very clear that the Fed really wanted to assure everyone that rates were going to stay low for a really long time. I mean, forever is what they were saying, basically. In fact, it was 2023 that they're discussing as a point that they would even consider moving from ZIRP, zero interest rate program, or 0%, the lower bounds. And at first, it was kind of striking. It's like, wow, whoa, look at that. They are really committed. They are going to keep rates down for an extended period of time. The markets like that. We want low rates. Low rates mean lower borrowing costs. It's good for companies. It's good for the markets. Liquidity is going to be there. Hallelujah. Markets were kind of mixed. They were moving all over the place. Dollar sunk down dramatically. The market ended up closing and seemingly like that. But let's just take a look for a minute and slide back the curtain just to understand a little bit better what this means and really what they were saying. It's 2023. Because didn't they say that we're going to see a recovery in the second half of this year and into the first part of 2021? Wasn't that the first and foremost discussion that the Fed was predicting and projecting? Now we're at 2023 that rates has to stay low for that long of a period. So they're talking about, instead of 2021 for this recovery to really take hold, we're talking about somewhere in the latter part, I would say, or mid part of 2022, where they get an all clear signal in that they are able to lift rates and their extraordinary means that they are utilizing right now, because the economy is not going to recover to that point. That's the underlying, what they're the underbelly of what they're talking about. There's that top line. It's kind of like the stock market, right? On the top line of the stock market, we have these large cap stocks that are doing really well, holding up the markets pretty dramatically over this period of time. But if you look underneath the skin, the underbelly of the market hasn't been doing so well. In fact, in a minute, I'm going to go over how the markets are doing from a sector standpoint, not only on a week-to-date, but a month-to-date basis. Very revealing, very interesting to take a look at. But when we go back and we look at, for example, the levels of interest rates staying low at this period of for staying this low for that long of a period of time, I think people scratched their head and said, well, what is the Fed talking about here? And I think what maybe happened after it sunk in a little bit was people got spooked. Because we thought we were going to have this really quick V recovery. That's what the Fed has been talking about. That's what the White House has been talking about. That's what everybody's been talking about. A lot of economists and analysts now, they're in this whole V recovery thing, right? Yeah, a couple of little swooshes out there and a little W's and a couple of maybe weird levels of a elongated U, which we're in the camp of a U, by the way. A U recovery for the economy. But I think what the Fed was saying was that they're very concerned. And I think that this really created a problem for investors because the thought of a prolonged slowdown and high unemployment for a very long time, which we will see, all of a sudden was being kind of told to us by the Fed in a very strange manner, trying to exude confidence and say, we're here for you for the long haul, but the patient is going to be in the hospital, not for 2 days, but for, you know, 6 months. And remember, it's a game of confidence. So they have to give us all the good news, all the things that will be helpful without telling us the other side. So the Fed's never going to say, you know what? The economy's in a rough ride, in a rough shape, and it's going to be very difficult to get out of this whole entire recessionary or the slowdown situation in any reasonable amount of time. And we really are very worried about unemployment. And do you think, have you ever heard the Fed say something like that? We're so concerned about the economy right now. No. What they tell us is they're dropping rates. And what that says is they're concerned about the economy. Now, stocks can act any way they want. Bonds can react any way they want to this. But the underlying fact of what they're saying is that they have a very large concern. And now that they're extending it to 2023, saying that we're keeping rates locked in emergency status until that period of time, they're clarifying what we all know already, that this is going to take a very long time to heal if and without a second wave and reverse of some of the phase-ins and phase-outs. If we have to slow down even further the amount of openings and getting the economy back to where we are, and on top of that, possibly even having some shutdowns around the globe and maybe even some states or some regions, that is a very big problem. So it's subtle. It's very subtle. But what they are telling us is that they have a very serious concern about the potential for recovery, not off the lows. I mean, if you have a stock or a company that has lost 90% of its revenues over a period of 3 months, like the airlines or the cruise lines, maybe some of the hotels, and now they all of a sudden start getting some bookings and they're up 15 or 20% from those low levels, that's not a lot. That is nowhere near where that's going to be. Just to put this in perspective in terms of math, you take a stock and you'd have it at $100 and you lose 90%, you're down to $10. A 20% increase off the bottom gives you $12. So now you're only 88% off instead of 90%. Got to understand the math here. I ask this question a lot. I'm going to ask it again to you right now. If you have a stock that loses 50% of its value in 1 day, how long is it going to take? Or not how long. How much is it going to take in percent to get back to 100? So you start at 100. You lost 50%. 50%. Now you want to get back to break even again. How much in percent do you need to get to that level? A lot of people are saying 50%, right? You lose 50%. I got to gain 50%. No. If you start at 100, you lose 50%, you're down to 50. You gain 50%, that's 25. You're back up to 75. You need to get 100% off of that level to get back to break even. So even though we may see a little bit of a tick higher in economic activity and maybe even some bookings and revenues and plane travel, et cetera, it's a long way from getting back to where we were. Not even a long way. It's miles to get back to where we were. So this subtle gesture of, or not so subtle really, of the Fed telling us that, hey, 2023 is the date, take that and understand that. Let's, as disciplined investors, as intelligent people, break down what they're telling us and understand what it really means. Because they will talk in riddles forever. So while they're not worried about asset prices, and they made that very clear, they said, hey, we are not worried about asset prices. In other words, they're not concerned about stock markets bubbling up. They're not really concerned about commodities until you get too much of inflation. Even when we get to that point, they're going to let it run hot for a while because they need this to recover. Here's the dirty little secret. The Fed, the central banks around the world have never been able to bring up inflation to a point post, I'll call it 2000. This whole idea of decreasing interest rates and holding them down to lower bounds, just look at Japan, going through quantitative easing infinitum has not helped anything but the wealth effect in the markets, which is fine because that's what we deal with on a regular basis. But let me tell you, you're out of a job, reducing rates, quantitative easing, buying bonds, that does not help you get a job. It helps companies with profitability potentially, and that may allow them to put more people on. But in this circumstance, and yes, this time is different. I know everybody hates that. Can't say that. Not allowed to say that because it never is. Yeah, this time is different. We have a totally different animal that we haven't seen ever before, really, in modern day economics. This whole mandatory stay-at-home order, concern about going out, health that is so incredibly intertwined in a pandemic situation with the global economy has not happened before in modern times. Trying to use the same tools that the Fed has always used to stimulate the economy doesn't seem like it's going to work to me. I mean, yes, some of the fiscal stuff, yeah, some of the money being sent to people in the form of unemployment compensation or money that is utilized for companies to maybe the payroll tax holiday or possibly the PPP program, even the stimulus checks that went out, those are direct payments. That is what helps this kind of situation. But just simply reducing down interest rates, think about it, it's so stupid. That doesn't help anything. Again, it helps bonds, it helps markets, it stabilizes things. That helps the wealth effect. It creates a level of confidence. That's good. Speaking about markets, we saw some of the most important areas of the markets get hit pretty hard last week. I mean, already the financials have been under pressure for just so many reasons, inclusive of the fact that rates are going to be low for a long period of time and this, at this lower bound. That doesn't help. And now we're starting to talk about this whole idea of rate targeting. You're going to start seeing this. Rate targeting, where the Fed is going to say, you know what, we're not letting the yields move. In other words, taking out the entire capitalism structure of our markets, taking away the free economy, taking away price discovery, taking away the entire way that we run our businesses from, well, whether you're an investor or whether you're a company. So we're looking at rate targeting, capping rates potentially, negative rates, and who knows how much more quantitative easing that they're going to do. So no wonder why the banks are freaking out. This is not good for the banks. The yield curve being flat as it is, low on the short end and lowest on the 30 that we've seen historically, not a good thing. Even though we started to see a tick up and a move higher last week for a little while there into the last couple of weeks, couldn't sustain itself, and bonds were bought like crazy again. Here's what we have. So we have some numbers on a week-to-date and a year-to-date basis. So I have the S&P 500 energy sector. These are all the ETFs that represent that. So the energy ETF, down 11.2% for the week and down 33% for the year. The financials, down 9% for the week, 22% for the year. Materials, down 8%. 10% for the year. This is last week and the year ago period, the year to date period. Home builders, which had a nice little run there, down 7.98% for the week, down 7.8% for the year. So they were actually positive for the year up until last week. Industrials down 7 or 8%, down 15% for the year. Healthcare down 5%, only 4% for the year. So again, last week carved out some of that. And this happened across the board for pretty much the rest of these. The telecom area down 5%, only 0.66% for the year. S&P 500 down just about 5% for the week, down 5.52% for the year. Consumer discretionary, amazingly, it's just because of the ETF and how it's structured, down 4.5% for the year, flat, 4.5% for the week, flat for the year. Utilities down 9% for the year. Consumer staples down 7.5% for the year, down 3% for the week. Technology, still a bright spot, down 2% for the week, up 8.44% for the year-to-date period. So what does this all mean to me and you? Where does this put us from a market perspective? I think I think all of the things we've just talked about confirms and really just solidifies the idea that we are in a major headline, news-driven, cycle-driven, 24-hour news cycle, market, and economy. We know the Fed and the government will do anything they can, especially in an election year, to help really instill confidence with consumers, with individuals, with investors. So, in fact, we saw that again on Friday. Larry Kudlow, a man who has never seen a recession that he has called. Okay? Never. He was out talking about, you know, things are going to be good. We're not shutting down the economy again. We're seeing real progress in the jobs numbers. You know, I saw something on Friday also that I thought was really odd. The Fed was out talking about how the jobs numbers were looking a little better. This was right on that market drop in that time period when the market started coming off. It was up 800 points on the Dow, 2.5% on the S&P, 4% on the small caps. Started rolling over pretty hard. And all of a sudden, as we're starting to roll over, there's this announcement by the Fed that they saw further improvement in the May jobs numbers. Thinking, what? Since when does the Fed come out with an interim discussion about an economic data point? Seriously, think about this. So now they're in the fray of trying to ensure that markets don't get a hiccup. Because they pretty much have put the entire kitchen sink at work here. While they'll say that they have a full range of tools that they can still utilize, they have really exhausted a lot of the potential. Yes, there's more money to be spent on bonds and junk bonds and municipal bonds, and they have a lot more money to do for quantitative easing. But after a while, you know, that kind of runs its course in terms of the uplifting mood of it. And they pretty much have no more room left on interest rates. Going down to negative is not going to help. So we know all of this is going on, and yeah, we also know that there is this whole rally has been a liquidity-driven MOMO into FOMO rally. And that's why we're still cautious on markets, by the way. This is why I've been pressing this issue of being tactical and reducing risk, in fact, and taking money off the table and having dry powder that is available for you because there's a lot of unknowns out there. Talked about this for the last several months about all these unknowns. That doesn't mean, again, that we're like, hey, no, we're not investing. We missed out on this rally. No, to the contrary. We participated. Just like we didn't participate in the full downturn, we didn't fully participate in the full upturn. Much smoother ride, and that's how I want to play it. Way too many unknowns out there. The opportunity to stay one foot in, one foot out, slowly and intelligently enter positions, again, for long-term investors I'm talking about, it's probably the best way to grow wealth right now. I just don't see the volatility anytime soon as we don't have any clarity on what's happening with markets because of the unknowns related to this virus, and not to mention the election year. An election cycle that's coming up. So there's two major issues that we talked about the Fed and about the virus and the expansion and the spikes, the hospitalizations. Those are what things I think markets are going to be really focusing in on because you know what? There is absolutely no good news. Let me make it very clear about this. There is no good news that is going to come from companies in the second quarter. This is why they pulled guidance. They had no idea what's going on. So analysts are out there just poking around in the dark. Now, the only thing that may be considered good news is that analysts will drop down their levels so incredibly that any number will be relatively easy for a company to quote-unquote beat, even though they're going to be obnoxiously horrible. We were closed down for 2 months out there. You can't have good numbers in that circumstance. So even as we do see that analysts are very positive right now, earnings above 120, 125-ish are going to be amazing if that happens for this year. And again, the multiple on that is what? At a 20-time multiple, that's, let's call it 2,600. If we have 130, that's a 20-times multiple in a recessionary environment. That in itself is laughable. So where are we now? 30, let's call it 3,000. We're talking about a 24 times multiple. Wow. With the expectation, because they haven't reduced it yet, with the expectation that we're going to go from 120 to 175 next year. Ha, ha, ha. Good luck. And there's going to be a reality hit soon, again, from this whole liquidity-driven rally until where we're going to get the real information out. That's something that's going to be interesting to watch. And that's why, again, and why, in fact, I'll just mention it right now, why we have told people and you and we have kind of let it out there that during the month of June, Investology, which is our robo-esque type of technology-driven and advisor-enhanced, it's actually advisor-crafted and technology-enhanced, that's what it is. But it is our way of allowing for people that want to just start out in investing $10,000, the minimum, utilizing some of the things that we do from a global asset allocation basis. Not a trading process, but it's more of an investing process. It is investing. ETFs, mutual funds. You get a copy of my book, The Disciplined Investor, Essential Strategies for Success, as well as this really cool challenge coin, Investology challenge coin. So go over to Investology. A lot of people took us up on that last week. You could do it as well. And it's only going to last for any new client that deposits money in the month of June. So make sure to take care of that. Over on investology.com, there's a way to just click that says, hey, start crafting my portfolio now. You go over, you register. There's no charge, no requirements. Just register, play around with it, and then see what kind of portfolios are created on the fly based on your risk tolerance and your time horizon. And with that, going to call it a day. Next week is coming on Father's Day. We're going to try to figure out how, in fact, I'm going to visit my father with all this going on and my wife's dad as well, who is in his 90s, do it in a safe manner, etc. I'm looking for more volatility next week. Let's see how that plays out. Monday night at 4:30 is, of course, the Horowitz & Company pop-up Q&A webinar. On Tuesday, it's going to be DH Unplugged at 9 o'clock at night, or you can find all these, of course, on your favorite podcast playlist provider. Also, this week, I talked about burgers. I was on the Foodable Network and talking about burger companies, comparing, contrasting all the companies out there and some of the new additions to the public markets that are coming. There's a particular company in the burger universe that looks to be coming public. So we talked about that, valuations, and where this is going. I will put a link to that on Twitter. So make sure to follow me, Andrew Horowitz. My handle is Andrew Horowitz, one word, and you'll get that as well. Until next week, I wish you the very best. Go out and have some fun. Stay socially distant. Be careful. Be safe. And I'll talk to you next week. Nothing discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice, or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training.